On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
We are delighted to welcome to On the Bookshelf Dr. Patrick Moore, who has been a leader in the international environmental field for more than 40 years, a co-founder of Greenpeace, who served for 9 years as president of Greenpeace Canada and 7 years as director of Greenpeace International. He was a driving force shaping policy and direction with Greenpeace as it became the world's largest environmental activist organization. And then he quit the organization. In his latest book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, from EcoSense Environmental. But we're delighted to have you here, and this is absolutely an astonishing book. But honestly, practically everything that you address in here, I have heard reported as though it were absolutely fact.
Yes, it's quite amazing, Doc. The number of major stories in the environmental field that are actually totally made up, totally fake. It goes all the way from the idea that carbon dioxide is going to make the world too hot for life any minute now, to all these other aspects about polar bears going extinct, which is a lie, that the coral reefs are dying, which is absolutely untrue. And as a matter of fact, coral reefs would like the Earth to be a little warmer than it is now because they thrive in warm water. And so we're being told a pack of lies, and most of them do have to do with the climate change catastrophe or emergency, as they love to call it. But there's a few that are on other subjects, such as the so-called Pacific garbage patch full of plastic that's twice the size of Texas. What's wrong with GMOs? What's in them that is bad for you if it's a genetically modified food? And the fact is there's nothing in them, and it's not only invisible, it doesn't exist. And you sort of know that because it doesn't have a name or a chemical formula, and everything has a name if it exists. So, you know, and radiation from nuclear plants is a separate issue, too, that has nothing to do with climate. One of my favorites, though, is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch,
yes,
which, you know, is out of sight for everybody. It's supposed to be in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. There's not too many people out there, so almost all the fake stories are about things that are either invisible, like carbon dioxide or what's ever supposed to be bad in GMOs or radiation, or very remote, like polar bears and coral reefs and a giant garbage patch in the middle of the Pacific Ocean that nobody can see. Not many people can go to the Arctic and count all the polar bears. Very few people go snorkeling and diving on the big coral reefs all around the tropics of this world. And so the purveyors of these fake scare stories, trying to get money out of you, trying to control you in various ways, are able to make up any story they want because the average person cannot observe or verify the truth of it for themselves. And that is my universal theory of scare stories, that these are things that people can't observe or verify themselves. And therefore, they're left to have to believe these so-called experts, when in fact it's politicians and bureaucrats who are paying the scientists to come up with these angles, and then the media and the activists are the bullhorn that spread them all around the world and make a whole pile of money on them.
You know, I can remember about 40 years ago working at the radio station and hearing reports that we were headed for a new ice age, and that the world was going to get colder and colder, and we'd better do something about it. And it was obviously our fault, you know, i.e. humans, and particularly those of us in the advanced world, you know, it's all our fault, so we got to fix it. We got to come up with money to fix it. That went away, and a little while later, we're being told, no, the Earth's not cooling down. It's getting too hot. We're going to all fry. All the ice is going to melt. Oceans will rise and swamp everything. Florida will be underwater, and you'll have oceanfront property in Arkansas, and it's going to be terrible. Just give us enough money. We can fix it. Don't worry.
That's a fact, Doc. You know, all through history, going back probably 10,000 years, people have been preaching doomsday, the end times, the apocalypse, coming soon to you. Guy standing on a street corner with a sign saying, the end is near. So this has been going on all through history, to scare people into giving money or doing or being controlled in various different ways, giving this up or that up. And the fact of the matter is, these guys are batting zero. there hasn't been any doomsday, even though they've been predicting it for 10,000 years. And there's no reason to believe in the doomsday prophecies that are going around today. But for some reason, people are gullible, and they don't bother to think, can I really check out if this is true? Because, you know, it's a fact. The world was cooling during the 60s and 70s. Not much, but enough to make it so there was no more snow in the winter and more ice on the lakes in the climates that have such things. And then it started warming again. That's been happening since the beginning of time, up and down periods of warming. But in fact, since 300 years ago, at the peak of the Little Ice Age, the world has net warmed. It's been up and down, but it has gone down and then up a little more, and then down a bit and up a little more through this last 300 years. And these people who are saying our CO2 emissions are causing this are forgetting the first 150 years when there weren't any CO2 emissions and the Earth was warming. This is a warming trend. There's no doubt about it. It's a very small one, a little over 1 degree centigrade in the last 300 years. But they're using that to expand it into some kind of apocalypse and calling it a climate emergency. The irony is this is one of the coldest periods in the recent history of the Earth. For 250 million years before we went into this Pleistocene Ice Age, which we are actually still in now, note that there are large, huge sheets of ice on both poles. Mm-hmm. That wasn't there for the previous 250,000 years. And this ice age is only 2.6 million years old. When I say only, 2.6 million years is a very small period of time in geological history. Life has been here for over 3 billion years, and modern life has been here for over 500 million years. So you've got to get perspective on these things. And the fact of the matter is we're now in a relatively cold period in terms of life's history on the Earth, and we're also at a very low point in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And they're trying to tell everybody there's too much CO2 and it's going to get too hot for life. Life has lived through mostly warmer times than we are having now, and it's all available to anyone on the Internet who understands that life didn't begin in 1850, which is about where these guys start off. When we started burning fossil fuels, everything before that, they say, is the pre-industrial era. Yeah, well, the pre-industrial era, it was 3.5 billion years of life evolving on the planet. Suddenly, we're burning fossil fuels. We're starting to live twice as long as we did before. We're healthier than we were before. And we have become aware of the environment, and we're looking after it better than we ever did before. We used to just burn fires everywhere.
Right.
And the air was full of smoke all across the country. And now, we have wildfires, and now they're blaming that on climate change, when in fact, I think trees have something to do with forest fires. It just strikes me that they may be involved somehow.
Yes, and the fact that because of restrictions, they're not being tended to. A forester, the job of a forester is to keep things kind of cleaned out under trees so
yes.
that animals can live there and that it's not just a tangle of dying things. And that keeps, keeping that kind of cleaned out keeps it from being great fodder for a big fat fire. But
you know, Doc, Europe was down to less than 10% forest cover about 300 years ago, as they were using wood for everything that required energy, whether it was smelting iron and copper or glassworks or steam engines or heating every single building in the whole of that area during the cold winters. So they'd invented forestry. Today, Europe has 43% forest cover. They have more than quadrupled the amount of forest cover in Europe over the last 300 years. And they look after their forests. They're the same kind of trees we have. They're
right.
coniferous trees, pines and spruce with a lot of pitch in them. They burn real good if you don't look after them properly. Mm. But they keep them thinned out a bit, and they keep the dead wood off the bottom of the forest floor. They use that for fuel quite often. And you don't see a lot of big forest fires in Europe. They can't afford that because there's towns and cities all over the place over there. It's much
right.
more concentrated population. Whereas here, especially on the public lands in the West, especially in the dry Southwest, where there's huge amounts of national parks and national forests, and they're just not being managed properly. That's where most of the big forest fires are happening.
Right.
Whereas in privately managed forests, they are trying to make sure forest fires don't happen and destroy their whole value, so they are not having anywhere near the kind of fires that are happening on the public lands.
You know, in Alabama, our biggest crop is timber. There's an enormous amount of timberland in Alabama, and I can't tell you when is the last time that I can remember us having an out-of-control forest fire in the state of Alabama.
You know, Mississippi has the highest forest cover of any state in the U.S.
Wow.
And it's also a very large percentage of his pine. The southern yellow pine, as the lumber is called, which is actually made of two or three different species, is the major forest tree there. There have been fires in northern Florida, I remember.
Right.
There was a fairly bad one, but nothing like what happens with the vast acreage that is burned virtually every year in the West. And the truth is, before about 1930, and in those era, when Smokey the Bear was born and people started really looking after the forest, there was even more forest burning then because there wasn't the population and everything was remote and nobody was managing most of it. But if you want to have a safe forest that isn't going to burn and kill people and burn their houses, you have to manage the forests that are close to human populations very carefully. The Paradise Fire in California killed over 80 to 90 people. They built that town right in a pine forest. Like the trees were right up to the streets and the houses. It was the craziest thing that anybody could ever do. If you have a concentrated population of humans, you should turn it into something like Central Park in New York. You're never going to have a fire in there,
right?
Because it's grass and shrubs and then groves of trees, yes, but mostly softwood trees, such as hardwood trees, I mean, such as oaks and that sort of tree, maples and those. They don't have the pitch in them that the conifer trees do, the needle trees.
Right.
And so it's simple, but the problem is forestry is being managed by urban greens, basically, these days, and they don't have a clue about how to manage forests. They've got a total fairy tale idea, and then they blame climate change when their policies don't work.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Dr. Patrick Moore, a leader in the international environmental field for more than four decades. His newest book is Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, and it's available from EcoSense Environmental. You can check their website, ecosense.me.
Best place to go, Doc, is straight to Amazon. It's on Amazon. It's sold a lot of books already. It has over 1,000 reviews. 95% of them are 4- and 5-star reviews. It's available in any price range from an e-book to an audio book to a paperback book to a hardcover book. All four formats are available there. And I can assure people, if they read this book, it will give them a completely new perspective on all these scare stories that are being peddled today by the fake news media and by the scientists who are basically prostituting themselves to get government money in order to fuel these fires. You mentioned before we went on, Doc, about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Maybe I should just go over that a little bit.
Yes,
for the folks
do.
That are listening.
Yeah.
Well, as you all know, we are told that there is a Great Pacific Garbage Patch, mostly full of plastic, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, that is twice the size of Texas. And if you go on the internet, you will find all these fake pictures showing this blob out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. But they're all photoshopped. None of them are actual photographs, except for the composite photograph made by the German satellite people, which shows the whole area of the Pacific, the entire Pacific Ocean, North and South Hemisphere, without clouds. That means you have to take a picture every day, maybe more than once, to make sure you get a picture of everywhere being cloudless, because somewhere is cloudy all the time. So they do this composite picture, and that picture is in my book, and you can see the Hawaiian Islands very clearly, and they are not twice the size of Texas, but there is nothing where they say the Pacific garbage patch is. It is totally fake. CNN bought into it 100%, and so did all the other mainstream media. Almost all the media have bought into it without ever sending an airplane out there to see if it actually exists. It doesn't exist. One of the pictures they show on the internet, which says this is part of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, is actually the debris that the Japanese tsunami washed off the land when it destroyed hundreds of villages and killed 20,000 people. Now, that is really such a fake thing to do. I knew it was a fake picture. When I looked at it, I could see mountains in the background. There's no mountains in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
No.
Those are the mountains of Japan in the background. And they took that picture and then said, this is part of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch.
It's incredible to me that there are, it seems, so many of these things that are touted as though they are absolute gospel. I've heard so many times people like Al Gore and others saying, oh, yeah, the sea levels are rising every year.
That's a fact, Doc. Actually, the sea level is rising a tiny bit in this warming period. But during the Roman times, 2,000 years ago, the sea was probably at least 3 feet higher than it is today. And this is proven by the fact that there are the remains of docks in southern England from around 50 AD when the Romans invaded England.
Right.
And there's also a town in France called Montereau-sur-la-Mer, on the sea. It's 20 kilometers from the sea today. It's a very flat area.
Yeah.
But the sea is actually lower today than it was 2,000 years ago. When we came out of the most recent glaciation, which peaked about 20,000 years ago, it took 10,000 years for all that ice to melt. And by about 7,000 years ago, the sea level has been pretty well steady since then, with little ups and downs as we go through little warming and cooling periods. Now being in a little warming period, but it's not as warm now as it was during the Roman warm period 2,000 years ago, and probably not as warm as it was in the medieval warming period 1,000 years ago when the Vikings colonized Greenland. And then the next couple of hundred years later, it started getting colder, and they were all driven out by the cold and went back to Scandinavia again and left Greenland behind. There were even some Vikings on the north tip of Newfoundland in Canada. There's remains of their village there today.
Yep.
But they also evacuated at that time. So there have been warming and cooling periods, and we are in a warming period now for about 300 years, so it may last for another 200 years, and then it will probably go back into a cooling period if the same pattern of the last 6,000 years or so is repeated, which may not be, because things change. Every once in a while, the cycles change into different cycles.
Yeah.
But here we are in this cycle now, and they're blaming it on our CO2 emissions when there is absolutely no evidence that that is the case. The main effect of our CO2 emissions is putting some CO2 back into the atmosphere, which was removed by life before. All the coal was made from trees. Those trees sucked carbon out of the atmosphere, and it turned into hydrocarbons in the ground. And we're now putting that CO2 back. So it's not as if we are putting something in the air that was never in it before.
Right.
We are simply restoring a balance to the global cycle by bringing it back up to a level that is more conducive to the growth of plants. That's why greenhouse growers double and triple the CO2 in their greenhouses, because it's contained. They can concentrate the greenhouse gases in there, and that gives them up to 60% greater yield. All of nature is still at a starvation level for CO2 because it fell down to such a low level over the last 150 million years. I mean, it's a long time. But as life has gradually pulled carbon out of the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide to make itself, it ends up on the bottom of the ocean. It ends up as coal deposits on the land. The oil and gas is mostly from marine sediments, which also came from life. All the fossil fuels are organic, i.e. made of carbon. The organic chemistry is the chemistry of carbon, the chemistry of life. So they're organic in the scientific sense of the word. This thing about organic vegetables in a supermarket, that's nothing to do with science. That's a marketing term that they're using to try to make you think there's something better about it. But never mind that. Fossil fuels are all organic. They were made with photosynthesis by the sun. They are the product of solar energy. And when we burn them, we are returning the carbon dioxide and the water vapor, which is the other product from combustion, CO2 and H2O. We're returning them back into the environment so they can be recycled back through plants again, instead of being locked up underground in sediments where the life cannot get at them and use them for its own purposes. There you go.
There's something else in your book that really was startling to me, and that is related to the mythical great ball of plastic. The idea that plastic is destroying the ecosystem and killing off untold numbers of animals. And to show evidence, they fake pictures, and you have reproductions of them in the book, of an animal that's just loaded with plastic. But you point out in the book that birds, having no teeth, need to keep something to help them mash up the food that they eat whole, essentially. And they either use rocks, or if they're out at sea like this, they use whatever they can find. And if they can't find rocks and they find plastic, that works pretty well.
It's actually the gizzard that is the right technical word. Birds all have two stomachs, one like ours, which is acid-dissolving soft pieces of meat and stuff, and the other one is for the hard stuff, goes in the bigger stuff, because they don't have teeth, so they can't chew their food up. And in the gizzard, there are hard objects that are used as digestive aids, basically. And as you say, on the land, it's easy for birds to find pebbles, but there are no pebbles in the sea floating around except for pumice, which is a rock from undersea volcanoes, and because it's porous, it floats. And that's their favorite thing to use, but it isn't always available. So then they have to scrounge for bits of wood, bits of hardwood, you know, like maybe half an inch by half an inch or 3/4 of an inch in the big birds like the albatross, and then bits of plastic. We've known for 50 years that birds are using bits of plastic of the right shape to help them digest their food. Squid beaks, too, when they give their chick a squid, you know, a 6-8-inch squid, they retain the beak, which is hard. It's made of calcium, and so they keep that in their gizzard. But these things wear out. Even pebbles wear out because they're constantly grinding them to grind their food. And all through their life, seabirds have to continue finding hard objects. While the chick is in the nest, of course, the chick can't find anything because it's in the nest. So the parents have to bring those hard objects all during the time while the chick is in the nest. And so, like Sir David Attenborough, for example, has proven himself to be an absolute liar about this. He and the Smithsonian Institute and Greenpeace are all saying that the adult birds are feeding plastic to their chicks, mistaking it for food. Now, David Attenborough wrote The Secret Life of Birds. He never mentions the word gizzard in any of his presentations, as if he doesn't know there's a gizzard in a bird that needs to have hard objects in it to grind the food. He's totally lying. And he's lying about the walruses committing suicide because there's not enough ice in the Arctic. That's another one of his big lies. You know, it's just really sad that he has basically turned into a bottom feeder, just like the walruses.
Yeah.
And he's saying that the walrus's home is on the ice. No, the walruses don't forage on the ice. They forage in the sea. They go down with those big tusks and dig clams in the mud underwater. So they can't live where the water's deep because they can only dive so deep. So they are basically very close to the shore. They are shore life forms. They don't go far from the beach. And when they haul out onto the land usually. And David Attenborough says that they're doing that out of desperation because there isn't enough ice. Well, it's funny that they call these haul-out areas walrus sanctuaries, like they're actually designated as places that this is where the walruses live, so stay out of there and don't harm the walruses. It's really a shame that so many people are engaged in this fakery of trying to tell us that plastic is toxic in the sea. Why do they think we put all our food in plastic containers and wrap our meat in plastic foil? It's to keep it from becoming contaminated, and plastic is perfectly sterile. It is not a toxic substance. And nobody realizes that cotton is plastic either, because it's a polymer too. The plastics are like polyethylene, polyvinyl chloride, polypropylene, and polyglucose. That's what cotton is. The cotton plant takes sugar and makes it into strands. So it's a plastic. It's a plastic that was discovered by nature 3 billion years ago to make cell walls and stuff, because it's a fiber that can be woven. And that's what the outside of a lot of bacteria is made of cotton, basically. That's what we call it when it comes from a plant.
Yeah.
But polyglucose, it should be called polyglucose, so people understand that it's a polymer of sugar molecules. And glucose is what's made by photosynthesis by combining CO2 and H2O to make the first sugar in a plant. And then that sugar is what is the basis for the energy for all the other metabolism that occurs inside an animal or a plant. And we should start thinking like a plant, because we all of animals are based on plants. If it weren't for the plants, there wouldn't be any animals. And the plants are producing all our energy and all our materials to get us started. That's how we got here, is because we're dependent on plants. And if we would think about what do plants need, well, what they need is carbon dioxide. And if then you look at the history of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, you will see that they have sunk to the lowest level in the history of the Earth in these past few million years. That's because life has been constantly pulling it out, and a lot of it ends up getting buried in sediments. All we're doing when we make concrete, when we make cement from limestone, we're putting the CO2 back into the atmosphere that marine creatures took out when it built its shells. All the limestone in the world is of life origin. It's, and so is all the chalk and all the marble. That's all calcium carbonate, which was made by marine life to form armor plating for itself, shells for itself. All of the coral reefs, all those calcareous shells they make for themselves are made from carbon dioxide and calcium. And so are the shells of clams and mussels and shrimp and anything else you can name in the sea that has a shell on it. It's made from calcium carbonate. And when the organism dies, it falls to the bottom of the ocean and gets lost from life. And so it's hard to imagine, but life actually was on the road to extinguishing itself by using up all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and putting it into deep sediments, where it got lost to the carbon cycle. We are restoring a balance to the carbon cycle by returning some of that CO2 back to the atmosphere where it came from in the first place. It's not as if we are adding to the CO2 level of the Earth in any way. It was already there before, and life took it out, and now we're putting it back. That's the central point in all this climate stuff.
Dr. Patrick Moore, our guest today on the Bookshelf, his new book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, it's from EcoSense Environmental, and you can find the book easily on Amazon or go to your favorite bookstore and say, have you got this book in stock? And if not, why not? And order me a copy now. Patrick, thank you so much. The book is so full of interesting things. We could spend another half an hour easily talking about it. We didn't get to talk about GMOs. So we encourage you to pick up a copy of the book, folks, and read for yourself and see the sense that he makes in this book. Patrick, fascinating book. Thank you so much for making time to talk to him.
Thanks very much, Doc. I'll come back on with you anytime. We could talk about coral reefs and polar bears for a while, too.
We'll do it. Our thanks again to Dr. Patrick Moore. His new book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, from ECO, Sense, SENSE, Environmental. Fascinating book, loaded with graphs and actual evidence disproving so many of these things that we've been told so often are absolutely true. We're told that the science is settled. Well, science is never settled, because science changes as the evidence changes. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.